Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net. It's Monday. This is Outcast World with episodes dropping Monday and Wednesday. And
hey, hey.
Just on the coffee there.
That squeak was my hips. I didn't take my cod liver oil this week.
I'm on the cod liver oil at the moment.
It's good for you.
Like an old woman. That's because I've been going to the gym and I got told it was good for my joints.
As per our TikTok comments, I've been on collagen, but the supplements.
Oh, the tablets.
Not the injections, yeah. Maybe that's what he meant. I was just glowing.
Maybe. Maybe he saw two queer men and thought, how can I make a remark about them?
Their faces look gay. I'm going to talk about it, even though yours doesn't.
Well, my mate Mark always used to say to me, I had a gay face.
Really?
You've got a gay face. But he didn't.
I think you've got a gay face. I think I obviously do.
I used to say to him, I think you mean handsome. On the show today, it's really interesting. I'm going to be chatting to Kevin Guyon, and he is he's a big dog at the University of Edinburgh. I didn't realise quite how big until after we spoke, but he's right up there. University of Edinburgh is one of the most prestigious universities in the world.
I want to read the books.
They're in that bag down there. Do you want to take one of them home?
Yeah, please.
All right, let you have
them. I'm really interested in this data.
I don't know where... Oh, no, he sent me it. His publisher sent me it. I felt very posh. So he's at the University of Edinburgh, and he's like a... He's not just a researcher. He's like, I'm going to look for what title he had, and I was so impressed by this. Look, Kevin, Chancellor's Fellow, University of Edinburgh.
Wow.
Director, Gender and Sexuality Data Lab. So this guy has written a couple of books, and they're absolutely fascinating. One of them is called Queer Data, and the other one is called The Rainbow Trap. And I'm thoroughly fascinated by them, because queer data is about how data, the use of data like the census and stuff, is a way of making queer people visible or invisible. But then what categories do we assign, and how do people's lived experiences of being queer? But the identities now are really fluid, aren't they?
Yeah.
So how do you capture that in the census and represent that people exist? Because that then influences how much money government spends on whatever. And another example is how certain organisations will have a sort of DEI, queer... pride network, and at the end of that, when you've worked for a big corporate, when it comes to its end, you are left thinking, have I been used? Did you want to advance the needs of queer people, or were you just trying to get yourself through the political situation at the time in 2021-22?
Yeah.
And how someone like, say, you or I offered an opportunity to do something for, say, a big corporate or a government department or something, how do we do that without compromising our values and make sure that we're doing what is right? So in what I did, I felt like I was given the opportunity to bring a quite progressive message to a lot of people that wouldn't have heard it normally.
Yeah.
And also, it was a great opportunity for me personally, so... I took it, and some people might say, well, actually, you're selling out.
Well, I think that's easy to say to a working class person, you know, especially if you're queer. There's like, you were like, well, there's two ways you can go about this. You can be the sanctimonious person who, if you're really that like knee deep in your rights and you have your beliefs, or you're somebody who goes, right, I never thought in a million years of my life would end up anywhere near the place it's got to.
Yeah.
Here is an amazing opportunity. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to Trojan horse it.
Yeah.
So sometimes it does take the, you know, you've got to be the, you know, suck up that corporate cash, use that platform for good. You know, this is it's such a rare occasion that somebody with, you know, flawless morals from a completely clear moral path ends up in a situation of power.
Mm.
It's so rare. Sometimes you do have to get mixed with horrible people and, you know, be in environments you don't want to be in.
Or hear things that you don't like. and have to decide which battle do I fight today and which battles are worth it in the long run. Yeah. And some battles are worth it in the long run because you'll get something over the line.
I think that if you're in a position emotionally and morally to be able to Trojan horse the business,
do
the
it.
CEO,
do it.
Person of power.
You're doing it for us all.
Just do it. You know, just you take a few of the bullets if you're a person of privilege, so that, you know, the people who are going to be really damaged by those comments and stupid presumptions and, you know, jokes that we hear in offices, you take the bullet because you're going to make it a little bit easier for someone else behind you. In an ideal world, we wouldn't have to do that.
No.
But look at America right now. Look at what's happening here. We're not in an ideal world. And I think we dreamed for about 7 years that we were heading towards one.
And we weren't. And people just come out the woodwork. They were always there. And in order to blend in at times of when things aren't as right-wing as they are now, these organisations, these people, they adopt different language so that they can sort of not get themselves into trouble. And it's just about being aware, isn't it? But also, like, don't shoot yourself in the foot and play the long game. And actually, it's okay if you need to do you sometimes. We all have to. You know, everyone's got to eat. So here's my chat with Kevin Guyon, who is the big dog in gender and sexuality at the University of Edinburgh.
Queer politics, sex, and culture. This is Outcast World.
So today we're talking about something that a lot of queer people feel but rarely say out loud, and that institutions, whether governments, corporations, are often far happier looking inclusive than being accountable. Some of us know this firsthand. We've worked inside places that will plaster a rainbow on your project right until the moment they decide that you're no longer convenient. And our guest today literally wrote some stuff on this. He's written a book on this kind of dynamic, two books. Kevin Guyon, the author of Queer Data and Rainbow Trap, is a thinker on how LGBTQ plus people get shaped by systems, how we're counted, how we're categorized, and how our visibility gets used to make institutions look progressive, often while very little actually changes. So today we're asking the uncomfortable question, how do we stop getting played? And if we choose to work with these institutions, media, government, universities, the big names, how do we do it with our eyes open and without losing our purpose or our politics as well? Kevin joined us now. Morning, how are you?
Great to join you, Graham.
Kevin, for listeners who haven't read The Rainbow Trap, actually, I'm referring to here, the book The Rainbow Trap, yet, what exactly is The Rainbow Trap?
Well, your introduction was just such a perfect summation, summary of some of the key ideas from the book and from my research and writing more broadly. I like to describe Rainbow Trap as a criticism of some kind of simplistic ideas we have about being counted, being included, and being brought into systems and institutions, which can often be well-intentioned, but can often sometimes be really harmful and really extractive or really damaging to the queer people brought in. So in the book, I look across a range of different sectors and industries in the UK, everything from the design of dating apps through to who do we see in film and TV productions, and think critically about what types of LGBTQ people are being brought into these institutions. What do we have to give up in order to be counted or to be included? So what version of ourselves do we have to present? And ultimately, how do we move forward? How do we build a path, whether it's in policy, research, activism, that kind of critically thinks about some of the risks and dangers that come with being counted and being included.
So how does it feel for queer people working inside institutions that love the concept of queer visibility whilst it's beneficial to them, but fear what I'd call queer demands, real queer demands?
Yes, I think it's a problem that's particularly unique to where I'm based in Scotland and the wider UK, where over the past 20, 30 years, we've seen a range of big corporations, media giants, universities make a real conscious effort to engage LGBTQ groups, communities, ideas, whether it's through visibility, campaigns, kind of promotions. That's not the case in many other parts of the world, where many queer communities are excluded and they're told they don't exist, they're made invisible. That's not the situation that we're navigating right now in the UK. So it's a trickier problem it's a trickier issue to kind of explore, but I think it's something that we should all be paying attention to. And I think we've definitely become more aware of some of the challenges in the past, maybe 5-10 years. Listeners might have heard of terms like pink washing, rainbow washing, and that are these kind of concepts where maybe big corporations, big companies, will slap a rainbow on their branding for the month of June, and then the rest of the year they're espousing maybe anti-trans policies or kind of rules and regulations that are ultimately harmful to queer folk. So I think it's something that there are pros and cons to both approaches. My book does not argue that we should go off and create our own queer island and kind of not engage in any kind of mainstream organizations or activities. But at the same time, just kind of scratch the surface, kind of think critically about words like diversity, like inclusion, like representation, and just think, who is this working for and who is this working against? Is this corporation only counting and including maybe people who are white, gay, cisgender, while at the same time introducing policies around trans inclusion or marginalizing maybe disabled or communities of color? So again, that kind of intersectional dimension, I hope, comes through clearly in the book, and this need for us to kind of cast net more widely. And again, just thinking about kind of what do we have to give up in order to be counted and brought into these systems.
So this is kind of, this entire subject is quite close to my heart in terms of I've been on this journey with numerous different kind of employers in the kind of sector that I work in, that really, I guess over the course of the last post-2020, they really fancied the idea. It was necessary, their internal staff networks and stuff across a whole host of companies, but like media is what I work in, and they really like the idea of the internal media, the internal LGBTQ thing, and let's do this. And then in time it becomes quite clear, whilst you're inside something like that, that actually they don't give a fuck about any of that, especially in the media, where they will double down on the anti-trans rhetoric. And you're in a situation where you're finding yourself giving air cover to people who not only don't share your views or don't care, or actively working against them. Like, for example, the reframing of the concept of like pride celebrations, you know, during Pride Month, which is the go-to for corporates, to reframe that as not the the real questions around pride. We understand pride now as being about protest, bringing issues to light that aren't given the light of day, all of the things that we should be doing. But I've had it said to me, pride is a party. No, we don't want to do that. We want to do the party. No one's interested in that. Is this something that you've witnessed across the corporate sector, the media in particular? I'm pointing the finger at the media in particular here.
I think certainly a range of different sectors, whether it's media, which I've done quite a lot of research and work in, the business world, the world of work. So I currently work as an academic in a business school. So this is really kind of rife across kind of corporate culture, but also personally. So as an academic working at a large university, as a gay academic, I know I'm kind of brought into view. I'm used for certain purposes to make the university look good in a variety of ways. And sometimes that can be positive. Sometimes there are benefits in kind of the diversity, kind of if you can't be it, if you can't see it, there are some positives to that. But what you've kind of highlighted in your question is, when do you end up being played? When actually is your identity, your kind of role within the organization, purely being used as a kind of tokenistic form of window dressing? And actually, to go even further, where are you being played in a way where you're actually causing harm because you're kind of masking over or papering some of the cracks that the organization is unwilling to address? So it's really fundamentally a push for more radical, more structural change about people's material conditions working in these organizations. So having a pride party in June feels nice for a few hours, but actually often what queer people want are better working conditions, more pay in their pocket, safer working environments. These are things that can't be done in a quick kind of pride celebration 1 month of the year. So it's this kind of broader, more ambitious project that the book calls for. And I think particularly in the context of the UK, this will be something familiar, I'm sure, to many, many listeners, whether it's kind of staff networks, whether it's pride celebrations, whether it's bespoke kind of training programs. All of these things can have good intentions and can do a lot of good, but they also can take up a lot of our time, And for queer people working in these organisations, they're often tasked with leading on maybe equality and diversity work, organising pride celebrations, doing all these
on
tasks.
On top of their normal
often
job.
Go above and beyond on top of their day job, often not being compensated for it, not kind of counting towards promotion. So again, it's just kind of a critical thinking about actually who's benefiting through these types of initiatives.
Do you think it's ever right to turn one of these things down, isn't it? Because it's tough, isn't it? It's like I've been presented with a number of opportunities to do stuff like that, and it becomes clear to me now the reason I, in, as an individual, was presented with the opportunities to do these things was, look at me. I'm white. I'd pass for straight in a lot of situations unless I went out of my way to tell you I was gay. I'm a white, cis, gay man from the usual background. And they wanted someone, these people have wanted someone that isn't going to upset the apple cart too much. They want someone that is going to fit in internally in the company. And I guess when you're trying to do the right thing, sometimes it's only afterwards that you realize you have been played, and these people are just wanting to kind of like make themselves look better. And that's clearly something you've encountered yourself. So you argue that institutions often invite LGBTQ plus people in only on their terms, as we were discussing then. And what do you think that looks like behind the scenes? Why is that?
I guess when we think about the word inclusion is a really, really interesting word. And I think what I hope to do in the book is kind of, what version of inclusion are we being presented? Whose version of inclusion are we being presented? And across the kind of sectors and industries I explore in Rainbow Trap, I argue that the version of inclusion on the table for LGBTQ communities is often a version of inclusion that works for the organization. So it might work for the media company, it might work for the dating app, it might work for the multinational company. It often isn't a version of inclusion that works for all queer people. And the problem with that is when this offer of inclusion is on the table, so you can come in, you can be an academic, you can host your own kind of radio show. When that offer's on the table, it's really hard to resist. It's really hard to say no, particularly when it might allow you to kind of showcase your identity, your experiences as a gay white man, for example. But the problem is, if you refuse an invite, if you say no, I don't want to be part of it, I don't want to be involved, I don't want to join the LGBTQ staff network, then the conversation can often shift. And the conversation can shift in a way where you're then framed as being difficult or being somebody who's being frustrating, being a stick in the mud, being somebody who's not willing to play by these rules. And that's what we see happening right now in terms of this current version of inclusion being presented across quite a lot of UK society, that it works if you're willing to jump through specific hoops, if you're willing to play by a certain party line, if you're willing to kind of go along with what's happening, particularly the kind of anti-trans rhetoric across many organizations,
particularly in media.
But if you say no, particularly in media, but if you say no, then you become the problem, and you become the person who's not willing to play by these kind of rules. And I think that's what we're seeing right now in the context of the UK.
I couldn't agree more. You write about gratitude politics, the idea that we should be thankful for being included. Why is that so sort of powerful and so dangerous as well?
I think it's something which I've been thinking through a lot just myself, and there is power in representation. There is power in seeing LGBT people in cinema or in media, in leading kind of large companies. But then it's often thinking kind of to what end? And there's this kind of phrase around kind of queer faces in high places and the kind of the limits of visibility politics and the limits of just seeing people in senior roles who are like you. Actually, what the book and more broadly the scholarship that my kind of research and writing fits in kind of calls on, actually those trickle-down effects actually benefit everyone. So my research and work looks at the tech industry, for example, and across large tech companies there's actually a fair number of gay men leading the world's largest companies, whether it's Sam Altman at OpenAI, Tim Cook at Apple, very senior, powerful gay men. Peter Thiel, exactly. But then the question is, do these technologies actually work for all LGBTQ communities? And my argument would be, no, they don't. They entrench bias, they inflict a range of harms on a range of different marginalized communities. So again, there's kind of limits of visibility politics, the limits of just having diverse faces in high places. We've seen this in UK politics as well, particularly along lines of race. The last Tory government was a very racially diverse cabinet.
Yes.
But again, the politics did not work for communities of colour across the UK. So again, just thinking about the limits of kind of visibility.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I'd kind of forgotten about that a little bit, the kind of like the Cameron era redressing of the Conservative Party to bring through new and diverse talent so that they could go there and then say that what had been done there was wrong. So they could kind of dress their front bench in a way that kind of deflected from their sort of far-right policies. And I think this is, again, in media, in the background I come from, it's exactly the same thing. What do you think of the psychological pressures that keep people silent in these organisations? I have my own theories on this, but I'm interested as to hear your take on that.
It's a challenge. It's something, if I'm being all on, speaking honestly, I wouldn't put myself in either boat yet. I wouldn't be somebody who is burned down the entire system, nothing works, we need to start from scratch. I'm not in that camp, at least yet. But at the same time, I'm not in the all-in kind of simple DEI initiatives are going to address issues. I think there are benefits to both. And I think in some sectors, some industries, these diversity inclusion initiatives do a lot of good. They bring people in, they create new opportunities for people who maybe didn't think there was a career for them in the space or place. It does address some basic rules about treating other people with decency, with respect. So I'm not yet willing to kind of write off all diversity and inclusion work. While at the same time, what I'm calling for is just more critical thinking about kind of when we're in these spaces, when we're in these conversations, when we maybe come from a marginalised background and actually find that we do have a bit of power in terms of who we might kind of showcase, who's usually bring onto a podcast, who we choose to deliver guest lectures in my regard at a university. Just making sure we kind of don't pull the ladder up behind us and create those other opportunities for folk in the community more broadly.
So I have a theory that I'm a huge supporter of DEI. Aren't we all a supporter of DEI? I know it's become a kind of dirty word. And my husband was the DEI lead at several organisations. His father run a race relations charity. So they come from that sector. And with all the best possible intentions, but DEI as a kind of industry in itself is a kind of thing that sort of the right lean into. And sometimes I've started to think recently there may be something in this that, you know, is DEI in and of the way we were delivering it still worthwhile because it became an industry of itself, or did it become a form of gatekeeping to kind of enrich and empower a small number of people who knew the lingo and the ways around these things and had the connections, which again becomes exclusive and to my mind kind of defeats the whole objective of DEI in the first place. It undoes it. It became to me to be the gatekeepers of the correct pronouns, the correct language, the correct way to go about things, the correct way to phrase things. Yet, you know, you've got people at entry level and organizations from a diverse range of backgrounds that wouldn't know this lingo and would feel kind of excluded from the conversations. What are your thoughts around that? I feel like I'm kind of delivering it in a small way some sort of right-wing talking points there, but these are just my observations from someone who kind of has been around that for a good few years now.
Yeah, it's amazing you say that. So when I read one of the first reviews from a new book, and the subtitle for the book is highlights kind of the dangers of inclusion. And one of the first reviews of the book, kind of somebody picked it up thinking this will be a right-wing kind of critique of diversity, equality, inclusion. And they were pleasantly surprised to actually see that the book is a critique from the left of these ideas. Right. It's not the kind of the right-wing talking points about DEI. If anything, the book is saying the problem with DEI is it's not going far enough. It's not radical enough. It's not ambitious enough. So I think it's possible to critique kind of these kind of diversity inclusion initiatives from both directions, both from the right and from the left. And one of my concerns is those kind of critiquing from the left have been willing to kind of cede this ground often to right-wing commentators. So DEI has become a kind of a right-wing target, something that the right can call out rather than kind of highlighting the many challenges from a kind of systemic, structural left-wing politics. So I hope the book speaks to that kind of conversation and contributes to that discussion. We also, it's not the first book to do that. There are many, for many decades, there's been many amazing queer scholars, activists, academics calling out the risks and dangers that come with being brought into existing systems and institutions. And we see this across a range of different spaces and places. Not to get too academic, there's some words like kind of homonationalism, homonormativism. These are kind of academic concepts that explain what happens when you bring some queer people into the fold to kind of keep the show on the road. So we've seen this in organizations like the armed forces, the military, global capitalism, the police. All of these institutions have made an effort in the past 20 years to bring some queer people into the organization, to bring them into the institution, basically to keep the show on the road. Because by bringing in this kind of palatable version of diversity, it then allows them to say, we are diverse. We are responding to these historical critiques and problems by bringing what we see as a kind of palatable version of diversity into the organization. So I think one critique, kind of speaking to your broader point of DEI, is it does sit in that universe. It can serve as a means of keeping these organizations on the road, keeping these institutions afloat, while just kind of tweaking the rules, tweaking the entry requirements only slightly to bring in some LGBTQ people who are seen as, they're not going to rock the boat. They're not going to radically change the kind of the structures of these systems. But it allows us to say we are diverse. We have engaged with these conversations, and that kind of form of tokenistic window dressing is a problem that's been around for a while. And unfortunately, it's a problem that's still here right now.
So what's the term? Faustian bargain. I've got that right, haven't I? Yeah. Let's talk about that as a kind of queer people often feel in organisations, like they have to choose between influence and integrity. And I'm sure you felt this yourself at some point. It sounds like we've had fairly similar experiences. Do you think that's a false choice?
I don't think it's a false choice. I think it's possible to navigate both worlds. I think it's probably a tension in all the work we do, in any organisation, in any job or role where you are out, when you're willing to say, I am somebody who is LGBTQ, what will follow from that is you become, whether you like it or not, you'll become a role model to others. People will look at you and say, I know myself, working kind of academia, working in writing, people reach out to you, they're interested in you, they're excited to see somebody like them doing work in that space. And I think that's a real, real positive. At the same time, it does demand more of you. As I said earlier, with these kind of organising DEI initiatives, it does require emotional labour to be, whether you like it or not, a role model to others, to be a figurehead for a community that seems impossible to represent. I mean, it's such a diverse community. One person alone can't represent such a diversity of people. So it is a responsibility for anybody in these roles. But the word integrity is also really interesting, because then the risk is that you then have to be perfect. If you do something wrong, if you kind of make the wrong decision, you produce something that you're not quite happy with, you then become representative of this larger group, larger community. And that's a real risk and danger. So we see that particularly in things like the media, particularly in things like film, where I remember the kind of the first gay rom-com, I think it was called Bros a few years ago, came out, this kind of first studio rom-com, didn't quite make as much money as people had maybe anticipated, and then it became kind of representative of all gay people in filmmaking. We see this across female directors likewise. If their film doesn't quite meet the kind of the target they were hoping to bring in, they're then seen as representative for a larger kind of group or community. So I think there are dangers and risks here about kind of being a role model, but at the same time, the risks that come with being seen as a representative for a far larger community.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? On a kind of left-right axis, that kind of something I've heard said a few times recently, it real nails it, is that like on the left of politics, on the more progressive side of life, really, we have a whole host of things that you're meant to do. Look at Zach Polanski when he was like, you know, I'm a good green, I don't fly, I get the train, I'm a vegan, I'm a this, I'm a this, I'm a this. And if any of that was not a tick, 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 he would be absolutely vilified for it, because he wasn't perfect. And he talks about, you don't need to be a perfect green. Whereas on the right and the more reactionary side of life and politics, it's kind of like, oh, well, people will be people, you know, and that's okay, you're still on the right. And we kind of like, I feel like over of what, in our world, there is an expectation that you would be perfect. And if you're not, you would be pulled down, and for the other side, so to speak, that's not really such a problem. How do you think if someone steps inside a powerful organisation, how do they protect themselves from being used as the rainbow garnish? And what are the red flags earlier on if you think that you've been brought in for optics rather than kind of actual impact?
Firstly, I love the term rainbow garnish.
I'm quite proud of it.
I might steal that for future, a future piece of writing. I think there's something... right now, my work is interested in the word of the word authenticity and being authentic at work, and what it means for LGBTQ people to be authentic. But also, again, thinking critically about that word authentic and what happens when you maybe join an organisation and you don't fit the trope, the kind of stereotype of a gay man, a lesbian, somebody who's trans. If you break those assumptions that other people will have for you in the organisation, are you then not being authentic?
Exactly.
So there is some kind of some academic work exploring this idea about the kind of the labour, the kind of energy it requires to kind of, in some shape or form, perform a character within a workplace, within an organisation. And if you kind of depart from that, according to kind of what straight cisgender colleagues perceive you to be, then they don't know what to do with you.
Yes.
If you are somebody who, a gay man who's maybe not flamboyant or effeminate, they don't really know how to kind of compute or digest you within the organisation. So again, this idea of being authentic or being this kind of rainbow garnish has benefits, has kind of opportunities, but also has risks and dangers. And I think it goes back to that broader point we've been speaking about throughout the conversation. Who's setting the rules of the game here? The rules of the game are not being written by LGBTQ people. They're not being written by these people who are being brought into the organisation. They're being written by straight, cisgender people, often in positions of power.
Guessing what they think gay people should be like. Yeah.
Guessing what they think this kind of, this the role the person should play, the type of person they want, the type of things that gay people do during Pride Month. It's very much a kind of a presentation of what another thinks about these communities. So again, that's a really kind of, the design of the gay, the rules are often designed in a way that are not going to work for everyone. They are going to create situations where some people fall between these categorical cracks. They don't fit the stereotype. They don't fit the assumption about who they're supposed to be. Maybe they're unwilling to play by the rules. They're not willing to be the type of gay person that their boss wants them to be. So again, I think just that broader sense of who's winning and who's losing through this current version of inclusion that many organisations follow.
I feel the except for queer men in particular, the acceptable queer man is Alan Carr. It is Tom Allen. It is Graham Norton. It is camp entertainer. He's gay, non-threatening, with the sexual edges and the political edges rounded off so that they kind of perform a kind of non-threatening role. Whereas in reality, queer men are just men that, there are, with a different set of sexual interests, I guess, and we're not allowed to have them. So, you know, that's something that I've seen time and time again, is if you don't immediately make sense to someone in a position of power as a queer person, then you're kind of excluded from what the straight people think the community should be. And that's really interesting, and it's something a lot of us have seen that.
Yeah, and it was one of my kind of... something that became really clear to me through work I did around the census. So one of my kind of entry points to these ideas, these discussions, was the national census, which took place in the UK a few years ago. And it was really interesting and exciting because for the first time, the census had new questions on sexual orientation and on trans status as well. And England was one of the first countries in the world to ask these types of questions in their census. But what was really interesting to me was some of the discussions around the design of the question on sexual orientation in Scotland. And what became really clear to me was there was very little pushback among politicians, among the media, in having a question on sexual orientation, as long as it asked about gay, lesbian, bisexual, or straight. Where there was a lot of pushback and a lot of media outrage was any discussion about having any response options beyond those categories. So anybody who identifies as pansexual, polysexual, asexual, these categories, these identities were often discussed as nonsensical. They were made up, they were invented. And it was a real eye-opener in terms of what was in the kind of majority straight mind was seen as an acceptable LGB category. And what was seen as just fantastical, as made up, as something ridiculous. And in those other kind of the broader LGBTQ community, those types of categories were often framed and discussed in that way. And we see this all the time, people speaking so kind of negatively or kind of just ridiculing identities like people who are asexual, pansexual, polysexual, seeing these categories as not a real type of LGBTQ identity. And often that's the view of straight people who are not themselves that category, but kind of speaking or projecting what they, how them being the kind of the judge about what can count and what can't count.
Yeah, they'd prefer everything to be kind of like a binary. I mean, look, even bisexual people are struggling to be accepted a lot of the time. That's not a thing. That's just, and that's a trope that continues to this day, isn't it? That bisexual people are not a category. And then you, people's minds are blown when you say, well, if you're bisexual and you're attracted to people who are trans, then you're pansexual. And then that, no, I'm not. Well, you are. And I think, spoiler alert, most bisexual people are actually pansexual, but they can't identify that way. Because, I mean, I always say on this show, I'm like, I'm pansexual. Am I going to put that on my social media? No, because I'll get people like, oh, what's he doing now? Fuck's sake. You know, people will be thinking I was doing it for attention. And yeah, that really kind of closes down the opportunity to kind of identify in that way, doesn't it?
Queer politics, sex, and culture. This is Outcast World.
Kevin Gallion there from the University of Edinburgh. Just the start of our conversation, we were chatting for quite a bit, talking there really interestingly about how we can be played in workplaces and kind of forced into doing organisations' work for them, and then when not required, stuck in the bin. So yeah, that was an interesting chat. Next time we're talking about how the very categorisation of queer data, we touched on it a bit there, but how just how we are categorised determines how funds and resources are allocated to us and how we're included in debates. And you see this through the exclusion of trans people and different identities from data capture across a load of things, from the census to organisations. All of that next time when I continue my conversation with Kevin Gallion, the author of Queer Data, and that drops on Thursday here on Outcast World. Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal, or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net. Top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.